Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Decision day. The Supreme Court upholds Arizona's controversial voting restrictions, highlighting the court's ideological divide. Then indicted. A top official in the Trump organization surrenders to authorities as the first charges are filed in the investigation of the former president's business. Plus, leaving Afghanistan. We discuss the many implications of the impending troop withdrawal with the U.S. Special Envoy for Reconciliation in the country. And work shift. A son of immigrants brings the tech industry to the often floundering economies of middle America through apprenticeships.
We can solve skilling and growth problems, as well as the equity problem that we face in America by creating jobs and skills for people that typically were left behind from the tech economy.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. On this, the final day of its term, the U.S. Supreme Court issued major decisions on some of the most consequential topics, especially as the debate over voting rights continues in Congress and in the states. The decisions also put the court's new 6-3 conservative majority in the spotlight. John Yang reports.
Judy, in one of the most closely watched cases of the court's term, the justices split along ideological lines to narrow the scope of the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965, just as states are putting new voting restrictions in place. The court upheld two Arizona laws that the Democratic Party says discriminate against minority voters. Marcia Coyle is chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. Tammy Patrick of the Nonpartisan Democracy Fund was an Arizona elections official for more than a decade. So, Tammy Patrick, what are these Arizona laws that were being challenged, and what's the argument that they're discriminatory?
So the first law had to do with provisional ballots being voted out of precinct, and that commonly occurs when a voter moves and then returns to their previous voting location where they don't live any longer, and that requires a provisional ballot. Some states, they allow you to cast a provisional ballot, and they'll count a portion of it that you're eligible for. Other states will throw out the ballot entirely and not count any of it. Now, part of the challenge with that is that in Arizona, there were almost 1,500 of those last year. And across the country, there are literally tens of thousands of voters who don't have their votes counted for president or statewide offices because they went to the wrong polling place. So this disproportionately affects voters who move frequently and or those who are in locations where they don't have good addressing, such as tribal reservations and rural voters. That same type of voter, that same cohort of voters, is also impacted by the second law that has to do with ballot collection, often referred to as ballot harvesting. This limits the options on how voters can successfully return their ballots. And we know that the Postal Service recommends you put your ballot back in the mail a week before Election Day. So if it's 3 or 4 days before the election, you need to get that ballot back in. And if you live in a remote or rural location, you may not have a drop box available. You can no longer mail it back in many states. And so those voters are impacted very negatively because they don't have the ability to turn it over to a trusted source in order to turn their ballot in for them and have it counted successfully.
So, Marcia, what did the court say today about the challenge to these two laws?
John, first of all, we should say what Section 2 actually is in the Voting Rights Act. And that's the section that prohibits any voting procedure that results in or has the effect of denying or abridging the right to vote on account of race. And you violate that section based on the totality of circumstances that show racial minorities have less opportunity than other voters to participate in the political process. So what the court, the majority did, led by Justice Alito, was to take that language, the totality of circumstances in Section 2, and he created a list of factors, five of them, that courts should consider when they're faced with Section 2 violations. And just to give you, you know, one or two of those factors, for instance, consider the how significant the disparity in voting is. There has to be a significant disparity in order to make out a Section 2 violation. Also, he said courts have to consider the state's interests. here in enacting that voting procedure. And he said that a state's interest is particularly strong, very strong and significant if they're trying to prevent voter fraud. And also consider the size of the burden on the racial minority voter here. All voting schemes, he said, put a burden on almost all voters, but consider, you know, how big a burden is this right here. Now, this was the problem that the dissenters led by Justice Kagan had with the majority's opinion. They said there was nothing in the text of Section 2 that lent itself to these factors, these five factors that the majority was creating. And all of these factors, according to Justice Kagan, worked against the challenger, created new burdens for those who want to challenge discriminatory voting practices.
With those guidelines, Marcia, that the majority laid out, the opinion written by Justice Alito, what does this say, or what can we infer about future challenges to voting restrictions?
Well, I think it's generally believed that they will make it much harder to bring Section 2 violations. And that's important because in 2013, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision by the Chief Justice, struck down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. And that section was a formula for determining which voting practices by states that had a past histories of vote discrimination had to have their procedures pre-cleared by a federal court or the Department of Justice. So what was left was Section 2, basically. And now with this majority opinion, there is a feeling that it's going, or a belief, that it's just going to put more hurdles in place of those who want to challenge what appear to be racially discriminating voting practices.
Tammy Patrick, given the new restrictions that state legislatures around the country are putting in place or debating, what's the significance of today's ruling to you?
The significance of what happened today is that it can give validation for some of the states that have restrictive laws on the books, those who are looking to implement restrictive laws, and also potential encouragement for other states to roll back more expansive policies. There's also a question around DOJ enforcement of Section 2. And I think for myself and others, it really does further the argument and the stance that we need to have a vibrant Voting Rights Act in order to maintain some semblance of protection for voters across the country.
Marcia, there was another 6-3 decision today with the six conservative justices on one side that the court struck down a California regulation that requires charities to disclose their funders, their donations, who gives them money. This was brought by two conservative advocacy groups. Next year, this fall, the court has already said it's going to hear cases on gun rights and abortion. They've got a pending request to hear a case about affirmative action in college admissions. Could we be seeing more of this 6-3 division in coming cases?
So I think, John, that if the court has on the docket next term abortion, race, and guns, that yes, these are areas where they can be very divisive and in which they may have a very difficult time crafting the narrow kinds of decisions that we saw this term that resulted in cross-ideological alignments of the justices. But remember, these are certain types of cases that do divide them. And I think the voting rights case, more than the First Amendment case today, is that type of a case. Otherwise, we just have to wait and see.
And finally, Marcia, last day of the court's term, traditional day to watch for retirement announcements. Of course, everyone's been watching Justice Stephen Breyer. What are your thoughts?
I think that Justice Breyer is well aware of all of the debate that's going on and the political considerations that are being talked about. And I just say it's totally up to Justice Breyer, and he will make the decision when he feels he's ready to.
Wise words from Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal. Thanks also to Tammy Patrick of the Democracy Fund.
Thanks, John.
In the day's other news, an indictment in New York charged the Trump Organization and its finance chief with what prosecutors called sweeping and audacious tax fraud. They quickly pleaded not guilty to paying executives with off-the-books benefits. Former President Trump himself was not charged. We'll get details after the news summary. Rescue crews in Surfside, Florida, halted work at a collapsed condominium tower today for fear the remaining structure might cave in. They cited growing cracks and movement in a large column. The decision came as President Biden arrived to meet with first responders and families of the victims.
The whole nation is mourning with these families. They see it every day on television. They're going through hell. And those who survived the collapse, as well as those who are missing loved ones. Our message today is that we're here for you as one nation.
Late this evening, work resumed for the rescue teams. The disaster 1 week ago has left at least 18 people dead, with 145 others still missing. The heat wave scorching the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada has claimed more victims. It helped fuel a wildfire that wiped out most of Lytton, a small town of 250 people in British Columbia. Residents fled just ahead of the flames late Wednesday. The Eastern Caribbean is on high alert tonight for Tropical Storm Elsa. It's forecast to strengthen and pass near the Windward Islands tomorrow with up to 8 inches of rain. No Atlantic hurricane season has ever had a fifth named storm this early. The White House is sending special COVID-19 response teams to parts of the country with low vaccination rates. That word came today as the CDC reported that the 7-day average of new infections nationwide rose 10% from a week ago. And the Congressional Budget Office announced that the federal deficit will top $3 trillion for a second year due to pandemic rescue spending. A new fight is brewing in the U.S. House of Representatives over a select committee on the January 6th Capitol assault. Republican Liz Cheney agreed today to serve on the democratically convened panel. She is a fierce critic of former President Trump, and her appointment sparked a verbal exchange between party leaders.
Another time, she will say her why and her purpose, but she has spoken very clearly about the committee, and that gives us great confidence that we'll be able to work in a nonpartisan way for the people.
It would be shocking to me for anybody from a party on the other side to come and want to accept a position, a Democrat from me, and it'd be shocking to me to have a Republican to go to a Speaker Pelosi, of all people, to accept a committee assignment.
House Speaker Pelosi also named 7 Democrats to the select committee. They include Representative Benny Thompson of Mississippi, who will serve as chairman. California's Governor Gavin Newsom will face a recall election on September 14th. State officials set the date today. Discontent over Newsom's handling of the pandemic has fueled the recall drive. In China, the ruling Communist Party celebrated its 100th anniversary with a military spectacle and a warning. Warplanes put on an aerial show over Beijing as thousands sang and waved flags. And President Xi Jinping used blunt language to put the U.S. and other foreign critics on notice.
The Chinese people will absolutely not allow any foreign force to bully, oppress, or enslave us. And anyone who attempts to do so will face broken heads and bloodshed in front of the Iron Great Wall of the 1.4 billion Chinese people.
Hong Kong also marked an anniversary of its return to Chinese control in 1997. Police deployed in large numbers, enforcing a ban on protests under a national security law that Beijing has used to quell dissent. Back in this country, the Los Angeles City Council approved bans on homeless people camping on sidewalks, under overpasses, and near parks. Supporters said that it is critical to getting 40,000 people off the streets. Opponents called it draconian. There is a final vote on it later this month. The National Football League fined the Washington football team $10 million today over sexual harassment and other issues. The team is not being stripped of draft picks, but owner Dan Snyder will transfer day-to-day operations to his wife for the time being. In economic news, new claims for unemployment benefits in the U.S. fell to a pandemic low last week at 364,000. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 131 points to close at 34,633. The NASDAQ rose 18 points. The S&P 500 added 22 to another all-time high. Still to come on the NewsHour, why prosecutors brought criminal charges against a top Trump executive. The U.S. Special Envoy for Peace in Afghanistan discusses the impending troop withdrawal. We examine the state of the U.S. economy and more with the head of the International Monetary Fund and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we reported earlier, former President Donald Trump's company and its chief financial officer were indicted on 15 criminal charges today for alleged tax crimes. Yamiche Alcindor looks at what it means for the company and for the former president.
The 25-page indictment against the Trump Organization and CFO Alan Weisselberg alleges that since 2005, Weisselberg evaded some $900,000 in taxes. It also says he did so with the help of the Trump Organization and its payroll corporation. To help us break down the charges, I'm joined by Adam Kaufman. He formerly served as a prosecutor and chief of the investigative division in the Manhattan DA's office, working with the current district attorney, Cyrus Vance. Thank you so much, Adam, for being here. So talk to me about the significance of Weisselberg being charged today. And what does this mean for former President Trump and the Trump Organization?
So what does it mean for the president, former president, and the organization? It's a substantial blow. What we see here is the CFO of the organization being accused of not just receiving benefits, but also orchestrating the payment of tax fraud, orchestrating a tax fraud scheme over more than 10 years, resulting in the non-payment of $1.7 million in taxes. So when we were talking and thinking about this earlier today, this indictment is actually a lot bigger and more severe than I anticipated seeing today.
And when you look at And when you look at the 25 pages, it's false accusations, it's defrauding. It seems as though this is calling the Trump Organization a sort of criminal organization.
Well, it's certainly calling it a criminal tax fraud organization. That's literally what it has done. It's interesting, if you read the indictment, it really spells out the many different ways that the Trump Organization and Mr. Weisselberg orchestrated this tax fraud. It's not such an unusual indictment. I know that the sort of sound bites coming out of the Trump camp would say that this is unheard of, unheralded. They've never seen such a thing, charging a corporation. The reality is that when I was running the investigation division, I probably authorized dozens or scores of indictments very similar to this one. What I see here that is a bit unusual is almost the scope of the fraud and the greed that it represents. So you have the benefits, the non-payment or the payment rather of apartment, car, and so forth. But you have lots of different ways that tax fraud were committed. You also have writing checks to employees from different Trump organizations and cashing those and taking cash back. You have payment of year-end bonuses, mm-hmm. and for some employees declaring it, and for other special employees not declaring it. Mm-hmm. What's also interesting, and it speaks to the exact intent of tax evasion and tax fraud, is that internally, the Trump Organization and Mr. Weisselberg as CFO were keeping very careful track to deduct from Mr. Weisselberg's salary the value of the goods that he was receiving and the services he was receiving. So internally, they're keeping track of it. But externally, when they go to the tax authority, they're not declaring it. Mm-hmm. So you really see a clear dichotomy between what's being, you know, it's almost like the classic two sets of books, which I think is very interesting.
Two sets of books. And also, President Trump is calling this a witch hunt. His lawyers were calling it a political prosecution. Associates of President Trump, to former President Trump, tell me that he'll feel pretty protected from all of this as long as he isn't charged. So what do you know, and what does this tell us about the possibility of other people being charged, and particularly the former president possibly being charged?
You know, we just really can't know the scope of the investigation at this point. There are a few things in the indictment that we can sort of parse out that might give some idea. We see the indictment refers to Mr. Weisselberg and other executives in the Trump Organization. So that's some indication that there were others involved. We see, you know, the fact that the tuition payments came from the Donald J. Trump Trust and were signed by the former president himself. So those are sort of interesting little pieces. The other thing I noticed, and it's sort of in the weeds, but if you look carefully at the indictment, the last three or four charges involve falsifying business records. That's a very common white collar crime charge that prosecutors bring, and it reflects creating some type of false entry in the records of the business. Two or three of those charges are false tax records, which you would expect to see in a tax fraud case, false W-2s, 1099s, things like that. The final count in the indictment, though, says that they destroyed a record. It's that they destroyed and obliterated a record in the Donald Trump personal ledger. And to me, that charge really sort of it sort of stuck out from the rest, because it sort of pointed to something much more on an intimate level, a personal level, between Mr. Trump and Mr. Weisselberg. So, you know, some clues there, but, you know, as far as the panoply of crimes that we've heard about, false valuations, Stormy Daniels, inflated valuations, false losses coming from international companies. There's been a lot out there that we just haven't seen yet. Mm-hmm. The question is whether this investigation is going to go on to look at those, or of course, if it's done and they've looked at that and they've decided there was no criminal activity. So there's a lot to be seen in the 4 months that we still have to go in this grand jury term.
And in the 10 seconds that we have left here, talk a bit about where this might go next. I know as a matter of law, grand jury investigations are secret, but where might this go next?
Well, I mean, you know, I just sort of laid out a bunch of other areas that I'm sure the district attorney is still looking at. So I would be expecting them to keep going through the records, keep calling witnesses who might be able to shine some light on exactly the scope of any criminal conduct in the organization, and of course, who was involved.
Well, thank you so much, Adam Kaufman, former prosecutor. We really appreciate you coming on.
Pleasure.
Over the next few days, the U.S. will complete the withdrawal of most of its troops from Afghanistan after 20 years of war. Nick Schifrin talks with the man who leads the U.S. diplomatic efforts in that country.
Over the last four decades, few Americans have helped shape Afghan policy more than Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad. He was born in Afghanistan, advised in President Reagan's State Department, was a presidential special envoy and then ambassador to Afghanistan during the George W. Bush administration, and has been the special representative for Afghan reconciliation under the Trump and Biden administrations. Ambassador Khalilzad, welcome back to the NewsHour. The Taliban across Afghanistan have seized dozens of districts. The Afghan army is ceding ground and in some places surrendering. And Afghan government cohesion is weakening. As you know, each of those variables existed before the U.S. announced this withdrawal, but all of those variables are accelerating. Given that, how do you justify the decision to withdraw?
Well, the withdrawal is based on an agreement that was signed almost 2 years ago. And that agreement had a timeline for withdrawal as part of a package that also included commitments by the Taliban not to attack the United States forces after the signing, to cooperate, not to allow the Afghan territory to be used by terrorists threatening the United States or our allies, and the start of inter-Afghan negotiations for a new government, as well as a ceasefire. So the withdrawal was expected. It could have been made conditional based on reaching an agreement and a ceasefire, but ultimately the president decided that it's best to conclude the withdrawal of our forces and encourage the Afghans, support the government to reach a negotiated agreement, because we don't see a military solution to the problem.
We'll talk about the political negotiations in a second, but I want to ask, that withdrawal is imminent, other than the U.S. troops that will stay at the airport and to guard the embassy. And yet, there is still no finalized plan on how to maintain the Afghan Air Force, no finalized plan on how to secure the Kabul airport, no finalized plan on U.S. military support from neighboring countries. Why not?
Well, we are working to address all of those issues. There is progress in securing an agreement with countries such as Turkey to secure the airport. We are still there, so that has to be in place before we are completely out of there militarily, which will be in September, based on what the president has announced. Two, we're also working with the Afghans to make sure they have the contracting services that they need to maintain their air force. And we're committed to achieving that too before September. So we're dealing with those two issues and more. We're also reorganizing our counterterrorism posture to have the access and the presence needed to monitor the situation in Afghanistan and to be able to strike terrorist targets should that be necessary.
So on that peace agreement, the Taliban are winning on the battlefield. Is the political process dead until the Afghan army can make gains, or frankly, the Taliban are at the gates of Kabul?
Well, of course, there are alternative futures. And the best outcome would be to start negotiations now. The Talibs have to know, and we have said that to them, that if they take over Afghanistan by force, they will forgo what they say they want, which is recognition and support and legitimacy. And we also believe that the war will not end with the Taliban advances, because other Afghans will resist them. There is the possibility that rather than two organized forces right now, the government and the Taliban negotiating, that with the organization of new militias that are taking place, the situation could get more complicated. Rather than two organized forces negotiating peace, there could be a multiplicity of forces that could emerge as a result, making negotiations that much more difficult, increasing the prospects for a long war and for Afghanistan's neighbors to come in on different sides, and thus repeating the situation as was the case in the 1990s, as you know, after the Soviet departure.
The Afghan government says that negotiation with the Taliban that you mentioned earlier, that called for the original withdrawal of U.S. forces by May the 1st, 2021, they say that that sidelined the Afghan government and gave leverage to the Taliban. You were at the time under incredible pressure from President Trump to withdraw U.S. forces from Afghanistan. But in retrospect, didn't the Taliban pocket U.S. concessions and never waver from their desire to advance on the battlefield?
Well, I mean, the Taliban were not going to negotiate with the government before reaching an agreement with the United States. It would have been better, of course, if they had negotiated with the government, but 18-19 years had passed and that did not happen. So our agreement, in fact, with the Taliban opened the door for historic inter-Afghan negotiations, meaning the Talibs and the government sitting across the table, for the first time in 40 years of war in Afghanistan that happened. Besides, of course, the Talibs agreed in terms of U.S. interest not to attack us after we had signed the agreement, but gave us the right to come to the defense of the Afghan forces, which was extraordinary that they would have agreed to that, but they did. And as our forces have withdrawn, they haven't so far, thank goodness, attacked those forces. But both sides need to be realistic. They need to find a solution that works for Afghanistan. There is great pessimism that maybe Afghans would not come to an agreement, but I hope that's not the case, because that would be a tragedy if they don't come to an agreement and the long war becomes even longer and Afghanistan's gains that have been made, the opportunities that have been provided by the United States and our allies would be put at risk.
And Ambassador, finally, just in the little time that I have, a little bit more personally, you've been involved, as I mentioned at the top, with U.S.-Afghan policy for decades. Are you comfortable with what's happening now? And how do you feel watching the news from Afghanistan today?
No, I'm not comfortable. I am unhappy that negotiations have not made the kind of progress that they should have between the two sides in Afghanistan. The continuation of the war is heartbreaking. I feel for the Afghan people. I have not forgotten who I am or where I was born. But I am pleased as a U.S. diplomat to have the opportunity to assist Afghans achieve a comprehensive and lasting peace.
Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. Good to be with you.
Even before the pandemic sent shockwaves through the U.S. economy, innovation has always been a key to success in business. Economics correspondent Paul Salmon looks at one businessman whose determination to locate his technology company far from Silicon Valley led to a new twist on a very old business model, the apprenticeship. It's part of our Work Shift series.
My grandmother's not the type of woman that you say no to.
9 years ago, tech entrepreneur Ankur Gopal's 86-year-old grandmother asked him for an iPhone.
I said, Grandma, why do you want an iPhone? I'm downstairs, you're upstairs, just yell at me whenever you need something.
But he obliged.
And sure enough, I was doomed to be her tech support. But as time went on, she became more comfortable with the technology and very proud. So proud that when my friends would come over, she would look at them and say, you have an iPhone 3. I have an iPhone 4.
To Gopal, it was an epiphany. He could teach almost anyone to master modern technology. He spent the years since proving the point, not in Silicon Valley, but in his native state, whose economy he's been trying to transform.
I came to Kentucky, where my parents lived in Owensboro, Kentucky, and worked out of their basement, very cliche.
And the big idea?
That we can solve skilling and growth problems, as well as the equity problem that we face in America, by creating jobs and skills for people that typically were left behind from the tech economy.
Gopal's firm, which builds mobile apps for major corporations, is based in Louisville, a city of 600,000, earnestly trying its own transformation. Its Main Street hotel featuring in-your-face contemporary art from facade to front desk, from lobby to basement to bathrooms. Just blocks away is Interapt, which Gopal staffed initially with college grads.
But as we started seeking people to come move from Boulder, Colorado, New York, San Francisco to Kentucky, realized it was a hard sell. And you know what? I'm just going to have to find people who like living here and then skill them up.
And by people who like living here, he means those who already do. So we offered locals a simple coding test with instructions.
We took 50 people, 35 of them passed, 35 of them are still working the tech economy now, and that's 5 years later.
Interapt now employs about 300 people and is expanding to other cities. And that's what makes this a story for the NewsHour's Work Shift series on jobs without college, and a story that's attracted media from the New York Times to The Daily Show, which sent comedian Hasan Minhaj,
its only brown correspondent,
to coal country, where he bonded with early Interapt hire Alex Hughes.
It's a really long time, bro. That's okay. I'm here now. Well, we actually had to do that 3 or 4 times.
Right, yeah, this is getting weird.
Okay.
But it was hilarious. It was a lot of fun.
But where Hughes came from wasn't so funny.
When the coal industry went down, it had a massive impact of the entire area.
Including his business services firm, which went bust.
I had been unemployed for 6 months.
When he heard about Interapt, looking for applicants. In his 40s, Hughes applied and was accepted.
Didn't you think you might be aged out of coding?
They were going to have to kick me out.
The training at Interapt is based on 2 precepts, says Gopal.
Number 1, everyone has to pass, so we have to put in the time, hours, to make sure that there's no one left behind and they all cross the finish line.
That's why Interapt's program is 2,000 hours, a full year, qualifying it as a U.S. Department of Labor certified apprenticeship and not just a coding camp.
The second thing I said is that we've got to pay people while they learn and not ask for any of this money back that we're investing in the training. Because you can't expect someone to learn something hard and take time out of life if they're worried where their daughter's next meal is coming from.
I'd always been interested in it, but you know, I couldn't afford to go back to school because I had a family.
This control board here is our Wi-Fi connector, so that's what connects us to the network.
Hughes now leads a team designing mobile apps for Louisville-based GE Appliances, a major Interapt client.
The phone talks to the cloud, then the cloud talks to this appliance, and we can make changes.
And the Interapt apprentices have grown more diverse.
I came into the program from a homeless shelter.
April Hickman, raised in foster care, now in an actual apartment with her 2 youngest daughters. Emergency housing arranged by Gopal staff. She had spotted a Facebook ad for Interapt's apprenticeship program while living in the shelter.
I just kept Googling until I actually found an application. Somebody called me right back and said we had to kind of go through a coding test.
Were you scared?
I was nervous. Yeah, it was crazy.
But she passed.
And I was like, yes. And so I was so excited, you know, like I was crying. I was like, yes.
We started with a very rural population. Then we went with a 100% African-American population. Same metrics, same results. The common thread between 2 people that you would think were very fundamentally different, they all had the drive.
This was everything for us. This was our shot. Even if we had to sleep in a trunk someday somewhere, I was making it through that class. Like, I was not giving up.
Of all the foster kids you've known, given the same kind of opportunity, mm-hmm. same kind of training, what percentage of them could do what you're doing now?
Oh, gosh. A great number, because it's problem solving. And if there's one thing that we're good at, it's problem solving, you know, because we've had to.
With the GE appliance smart home.
Melanie Trass, who manages client relations, says the company's openness to hidden talent gives it a distinct edge.
Since we are targeting those communities where people are being left behind, we are highly diverse within our organizations. So many clients are seeking that. It's part of the texture right now across America, upskilling, reskilling, and giving people a seat at the table where they normally may have not had a pathway. So we help create the path.
This is one of the first appliances that I got to work on.
At GE Appliances, Alex Hughes and apprentice Corey Thomas were meeting with the executives in charge of Interapt's contract.
Our relationship with Interapt is one of those ways that we find diverse thought and resources right here in our backyard.
VP Sean Stover first hired Interapt to work on the Opal ice maker.
The southern states, we like our ice chewable.
Chewable?
Yeah.
So can I defile this particular drink, but I want to see what this is like. Oh, yeah. You're not jeopardizing your teeth in any way here.
Right.
So now, a new, more challenging assignment, an app for GE Appliances' new camera-equipped oven.
I can use artificial intelligence, object recognition, to put something in the oven, press start, and it just cooks it.
Starting with pizza.
A lot of different pizzas, too. So it's mm-hmm. vegetarian pizzas versus the...
I'm curious on how that would work.
Right, right. Yeah. So we're
engineering director Irina McDowell was giving Corey Thomas his marching orders.
What does the user want? Do they want a less done or do they want a more done pizza? And then being able to send that information to the cloud, right? Would you like to see the cheese bubbling?
Oh, yeah, cheese bubbling. Mm-hmm.
Ironically, Corey Thomas's last job before Interapt also involved making pizza as a line cook in a joint near his parents' house.
It's called Tony Boombas. I'd say most of the time I was there is minimum wage.
And now you're designing apps for people who would be cooking pizza.
I am ecstatic, pretty much.
Pretty good for a kid who hated high school, shunned college, spent 3 unhappy years in the Army.
We've taken the C, D, and F student in the back of the high school and put them in a vocational coding program, and they've been the top performer in the class.
To Ankur Gopal, such students are fruit just waiting to be plucked.
2/3 of the people don't have a college degree, so to us, that's untapped potential.
This is going to let us flip a switch, see what happens in-app.
We said, let's go and find the people that could still be very good at a job in the tech field, and that's exactly who we find.
Find and train. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solomon.
The fiscal and monetary policies implemented by the U.S. government in the past year, along with the falling numbers of new COVID cases, should pave the way for a robust U.S. economic recovery, although real challenges remain. That was the general conclusion of an annual report released today by the International Monetary Fund. It projects that the U.S. economy will grow roughly 7% this year as federal stimulus programs fuel consumer spending. But that growth raises the risk of inflation. The report also emphasizes that the pandemic itself remains the greatest threat to any nation and urges the U.S. to help other countries cope with the health crisis. Kristalina Georgieva is managing director of the International Monetary Fund, and she joins me now. Director Georgieva, it's so good to have you with us again. I want to ask you about those economic projections, but let's start with COVID and the effect it has had on the world. You and the IMF are calling this week for countries that can afford to do so to particularly help the countries on the African continent, sub-Saharan Africa, with more doses of the COVID vaccine. Why is this important, and do you expect to get the help you need?
It is very important for everyone, everywhere. Why? Because what we are facing in the world is a two-track vaccination path that leads to two-track economic recovery. In the United States, vaccinations have exceeded 50%. In many other advanced economies, they are going up in the territory that allows the economies to fully reopen. Whereas in many developing countries, and especially in low-income countries, vaccination rates are extremely low. In Africa, less than 1% of the adult population is fully vaccinated, and yet we see the new Delta variant causing a third very rapidly going up wave of infections in Africa. The impact of this is twofold. One, it is holding the recovery of the world economy back and, of course, harming people tremendously. We calculate that if we accelerate vaccinations, if we vaccinate the world to 40% this year, 60% by middle next year, we will gain $9 trillion in output between now and 2025. And 40% of this gain will be for advanced economies because of this rapid recovery of the world. And two, because when we don't vaccinate people, we leave patches as fertile ground for new mutations that are ricocheting back in the developed world.
Right. And what I want to ask you is the United States, as you know, has already pledged to give 500 million doses or more to over 100 of the world's poorest countries. How much more are you asking the U.S. to do?
So far, we have gotten about 1 billion doses pledged to increase vaccinations in developing countries. But we are still significantly short. We need 11 billion doses for the world, And we need next year to get to a excess production of vaccines. So we vaccinate those who need it, and we secure boosters if that becomes necessary. So to answer your question, the US is doing a very good job leading the world with offering additional vaccines, but we need more.
And it's a subject I know that so many people know is important and could pursue. But I also want to talk to you about the economy and the bounce back from the pandemic. As I reported a moment ago, you, the IMF, today projecting U.S. economy will grow 7%, a remarkable rate of growth this year. What does that mean for the world? We know the entire global economy took a big hit from this pandemic. What does this improvement here in the United States going to mean for the whole world?
Let me first recognize the two foundations for this strong growth. The stimulus that was put in place to inject money in the hands of people and support businesses, and the accelerated vaccination push that US has been pursuing over the last months. They both lead to this remarkable recovery that would deliver the highest growth rate in the United States since 1984, a generation ago. What does it mean for the rest of the world? Primarily good news, because higher growth in the United States means that the United States is going to be demanding more goods from other nations and is in that way exporting some of this growth momentum. This is why our message is very simple. Vaccine policy this year, next year, is economic policy. Let's vaccinate the whole world.
So in a few words, Director Georgieva, what should Americans, what should the United States be doing in the year, the next year, couple of years to come to see the world move forward in total, together, in a positive direction?
Well, first and foremost, the United States ought to continue to build its competitiveness and the vibrancy of its economy, because as the largest economy in the world, when the US does well, that is good for everybody. And in this sense, we very warmly welcome the two plans that are now under consideration, the jobs and the families plans. They are going to inject more productivity, higher labor market participation in the US that would boost between 2022 and 2024 growth in the US by 5.25 percentage points. And it would also take care of people in the United States that have been hit the hardest by this pandemic, women, Black and Hispanic communities. So that action in the US is beneficial for the world directly and also indirectly as a leadership as to how tax policy and spending policy can lead to a more vibrant and fair economy in the future.
A number of policies of this administration. Kristalina Georgieva, the Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alonzo King is a visionary choreographer who is altering the way we look at dance. Born in Georgia to civil rights activist parents, King found his own form of expression through the language of movement and ultimately went on to found Alonzo King Lines Ballet, a San Francisco-based dance company. Tonight, he gives his brief but spectacular take on life and movement. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
I see everything as movement. I think movement and sound is everywhere. If you think of the Big Bang Theory, what came first? Motion, vibration, sound, they're the same. My parents were civil rights leaders in Albany. My father was president of the Albany movement. He was very close friends with Malcolm X. They traveled together. The impact that my parents had on me was watching people who actually lived what they preached. And that was intimidating and inspiring. As a kid, my father introduced me to yoga. That had a huge impact on me. It is also curious, the idea of the East-West merger, and in terms of civil rights, it was, you know, Martin Luther King and that relationship with Gandhi and nonviolence, and that power of love was much more powerful than enmity or violence. And so that taught me later about the balancing act that's needed between left brain and right brain. You know, I think all children have a relationship with movement. There's something about the children that catches the whirls, W-H-I-R-L-S, of motion that are happening. You always see children, whether they've even seen one or not, they play airplane. They go on the axis, they go out on the circle. And so there's these currents that exists internally and externally. When you plunge into the heart of movement, the outer world dims because you're so in the moment and everything else becomes peripheral. When you think about dance, often, too often, people think of it as not being a language, but it is a language. Music is thought made audible. Dance is thought made visible. And so music and movement, or sound and vibration, they are the same. My name is Alonzo King, and this is my brief but spectacular take on life and movement.
A nice thing to hear at the end of this day. And you can see all of our brief but spectacular episodes at pbs.org/newshour/brief. On the NewsHour online right now, several western states are in the grips of a historic drought that has depleted key water sources to a frightening level. All this now in the midst of a record-breaking heat wave. We look at what's happening on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.